So we're on the third and final night of ramble around reality. In this case, we're discussing the power of the Dhamma to transform society. Very briefly recapitulate the last couple of days. Some of you, I know, are here for the first time, but I hope that you'll get some idea of where we are and where we're going. So I've been looking at the power of the Dhamma to transform not merely ourselves, but the society around us, the world around us. And I've been explaining that that power lies in two sets of laws, you could put it like that. Laws in the sense that gravity is a law, or and my science is so limited I can't even think of it. Laws of thermodynamics or something like that. So within reality there are a range of different laws, but there are laws that govern the way in which our own conscious intentions modify our own minds. So just as we've been now developing consciously thoughts of loving kindness for self, for others and so forth, that has an effect on us as well as on others too, but it modifies us internally. We're deliberately cultivating skillful karma. Karma means action. A thought is an action. So we were deliberately thinking, may I be well, may I be happy. And that modifies you. You are different as a result of doing that, maybe very subtly, maybe to a very small degree. So that's the first power that we have, to modify ourselves so that we become more and more fulfilled, more and more in tune with the world around us, more and more kindly, more and more compassionate, and more deeply understanding of life, therefore more fulfilled, yes. So that's the first set of laws that we're trying to activate in our own lives, that we're trying to bring others to activate in their lives so that they change their world. And if enough of us do that, it'll be a very different world. If enough people do develop skillful mental states and deliberately develop their human possibilities, it'll be a very different world. Because it's not only Buddhists who encourage this. Fortunately, if it was left to Buddhists, it'd be a pretty poor show. But many different teachings, many different attitudes, philosophies, religions encourage basic positive mental states. Fortunately, there are not merely Buddhists who are doing this, but Buddhists do it in the context of this understanding of karma, which allows us to locate what's happening in the natural world, you could say. It's not something that we locate in a supernatural world. It's part of the way things are, just as gravity is part of the way things are. If you act in a skillful way, your own mind develops to your own benefit and the benefit of others. If we can get enough people to do that, that will hugely change the world around us. But there's another set of laws which are a little bit more difficult to understand, although we do, probably most of us, have some inkling in our own experience of what they mean. These laws are called laws of dharma. I could give you a whole three-day ramble on what the dharma means, but for present purposes, let's not define it. Let's just talk about these processes that are unleashed to the degree that you stop being selfish, to the degree that you stop focusing everything back on yourself, something new starts coming into play. Something that seems to unfold spontaneously. You don't have to will it. You don't have to sit down and will, may I be selfless, and so forth. It's as if once you've really seen through the limitations of our usual way of thinking about who we are, something new comes into play, which doesn't come from anywhere else, if you see what I mean. It's not supernaturally motivated, according to Buddhism, at least in the crudest sense. But it's not egoically motivated. It doesn't come from your personal will. It's when your personal will is, so to speak, suspended that it starts to come into operation. And everybody will have had glimpses of this, I'm sure. Perhaps particularly in moments of creativity or of compassionate response. And I saw a lady fell off her bike here, and some of our friends were just immediately went and helped her. They didn't know her, they had no connection with her, as far as I know. They just helped her, and I could see that they were doing it without even thinking. They just did it. It's a small example. In the end, that becomes something that, if I say it takes you over, it gets a bit spooky, but something that just becomes you. You become this stream of altruistic mental states, this stream of compassionate willing that you don't even have to think about. And Buddhism is directed to unleashing those forces within you, to put it that way. Metaphors get so complicated here. Don't they say that God is in the grammar? The way in which we talk sort of seems to suggest a sort of metaphysical underpinning. In Buddhism, we eschew all that. What we simply say is, this is what we see. We see that once you recognize the limitations of self-clinging, you recognize the limitations of our usual conception of self, something else starts to come into play. Oh dear, I could get going. I'm getting going and I've got to stop and move on. It's a remarkable topic. So we're talking about how we bring these two processes, these two conditioned processes, to bear on the society around us so that it moves in a better direction. And my goodness, does it need it. And I started yesterday, badly timed myself, I started talking about what I consider to be the three major areas in which we can think about how to work. And I talked extensively yesterday, too extensively, I got overexcited, about how we can bring the forces of the Dhamma to bear to help those who are excluded, marginalised, oppressed, are suffering deeply within society. You know, it happens here, but this is a relatively benign society. I think, no doubt, some people would contradict me, but I think that it is. And I spend a lot of time in India, 6 months of my year in India, and although there are very, very good people in India, I see an awful lot of inhumanity on an astonishing scale. And elsewhere too. We're very capable of it here. But the Dhamma can help people who find themselves in that sort of situation by showing them that their own future is in their hands. It's not entirely in their hands, of course. None of us have complete control over our lives. We're only tiny creatures in a vast universe which is full of forces that are way beyond our control. We cannot ask the sun to rise. It does it under its own impetus, so to speak. But we can all the time decide on our own mental states. We can all the time decide how we will act. And we can choose to act in ways that are skillful. We can choose to act in ways that are unskillful, ways that are harmful and destructive. Or we can choose to act in ways that are constructive, creative, helpful. We can, for instance, decide that we are not going to put up with certain forms of exclusion. This might be strange to say that that's a positive action, because usually it's conceived of as fighting. But in a way, that the struggle for dignity is a positive one, if you see what I mean. It may involve saying no. It may involve insisting on things. It may even involve direct action of various kinds. demonstrations and so forth are necessary at times. But they're done in a positive spirit, in a desire to create a better life for yourself, a better life for others, a desire to change the oppressive context. So I said that this is not idle theory. We have exemplification of this on a huge scale, of course, in many places, but I'm especially conscious of it in India, where some 30 million people who would formerly have been considered untouchable, would formerly have thought of themselves as untouchable, have, to varying degrees, stood up and changed themselves, and thereby changed the world around them to some extent. And I mentioned that the statistics prove the effectiveness of their becoming Buddhist. In this very basic human sense, most of them don't meditate. They don't know so much about Buddhism. What they know is that their destiny is in their hands. They know that they are responsible for their own mental states. They know that living decently, in accordance with the precepts, will be good for them and good for society. And it's radically changed who they are and their place in society. If you missed that, I went into it extensively yesterday. Hastening on. So my second area, and again, I'm not going to deal with this as fully as I would like to, although it's a vast and important area. Maybe next rambles will be on this theme. We're faced with this particularly starkly when we consider a society which is very obviously unjust, you know, a caste-based society or a racist society, an extreme nationalist society of various kinds, where people are very obviously treated inhumanly. There's obviously a system to be dealt with, as well as something for the individuals to stand up for, if you see what I mean. So my Buddhist friends in India have stood up for themselves, which has made a big difference to their own lives, but there's still a system which is oppressing huge numbers of their brothers and sisters. You know, it's said that there are probably 200 million Dalits in India, formerly untouchable. Something like that. Something like 30 million have become Buddhists. A number of found ways of asserting themselves through other ways of thinking. But, you know, that means something like 150, 170 million people who still are subject to the old internal experience and the external one. So we need to think about the system. We need to think about the system which creates that sort of injustice and oppression. And we need to think about the system on which different societies run, including the one that we have here, the relatively benign, I assure you, I know it's only relatively benign, system within which we function. It has so many areas of unsatisfactoriness, at the very least, if not outright injustice. It, by and large, what I think we're mostly faced with here is a system that does not adequately deliver real satisfaction and fulfilment to the vast majority of its citizens. You know, there are so many different aspects of this to pick out, but I wanted to sort of pick out this particular element of it. In this country, in Britain, the predominant underlying perspective is materialist. I mean materialist not merely in the consumerist sense. I mean materialist in the strict philosophical sense of believing that only matter really exists and that consciousness is merely an epiphenomenon, a sort of a momentary glow on the edge of matter, which lasts a lifetime and then is snuffed out and was essentially without any real significance. That's the prevailing view, and it plays itself out in terms of consumerism. materialism in that sense. We in the 20th, well, no, not the 20th century anymore, which century is it? 21st century. I'm an old hippie, I've never died. In this 21st century, we live at a time where the system, at least for a while, is more efficient at delivering superficial satisfaction than any society has ever been in human history for a larger number of people. You know, aristocrats could enjoy good lives in the past and so forth. Privileged castes and communities and races could enjoy it. But the vast majority of people lived in a poverty, a penury, oppression. But we have a society in Britain that delivers, even to people who are considered poor, astonishing levels of material well-being. I know that's a complex statement. Please recognise I'm making generalisations and I'm aware of the exceptions. But it really is quite remarkable. And it's extremely good at it. It's extremely good at keeping us hooked to it. It's a system that feeds on the fact that we get some pleasure from our latest, well, to use something topical in a community that I'm staying in at the moment, our iPad. No names are being mentioned. No, he hasn't got an iPad. You have your iPad. You get your new iPad. It's not that I want one, I assure you. No, I don't want it. You get your new iPad and you feel, you just sit and you look at it and you feel really good about it. And, marketing psychology tells us that there will be a sort of increase in well-being when you get a new product, a bigger house or whatever. And they know how long that lasts. And blow me down, when that starts to fade away, a mark four comes out. The system is actually geared to our discontent, our satisfaction and discontent. We have an incredibly efficient system for keeping us hooked to a sense that life is getting better. And soon as we begin to get discontented, somebody else has the mark five and you go and get it. That's the predominant system we have here that we need to confront. Of course, there are many other aspects of this system that we need to confront. There are certain assumptions, for instance, about foreigners that are quite commonly held about, you know, the need to defend our island race and all that sort of stuff. Although it's a little bit old hat, fortunately, there are modified versions of it. There are all kinds of views and attitudes that are commonly held within society that politicians deliberately play upon and manipulate to gain power so that they get all the benefits of power. No doubt some of them are highly idealistic, but very difficult to sustain that idealism. We'll come to that a bit later if I manage to get there. So we have a system that is extremely compelling, that we all very easily become caught up with, and even in, you know, renunciant Buddhists, they have all the latest gadgetry. Not me, I don't have, but they do, them. It's very difficult to check out of. You sort of almost have to. And that you're caught up with many things that are just trivial, superficial, that depend upon the exploitation of people in other parts of the world, neglect the historical imbalances that have been created. A lot of the wealth that we enjoy in this country and the privilege that we enjoy in this country, the freedom that we enjoy in this country, is based upon the colonial exploitation of the 19th and early 20th centuries. And, of course, that transmogrifies into a different kind of exploitation. None of these are simple judgments. They're much more complex than that, and benefits flowed as well as exploitation. But nonetheless, we enjoy the fruits of that. There are attitudes to our position in the world that sort of deny the reality of our interconnectedness. Just today, I had a talk with one of the fundraisers, Amal Avadra. He was here. He walked out. I don't know whether he's discussed it already. He was saying that something he's encountering more and more in appealing for funds for our work in India is either I think people should stand up for themselves, so I don't want to give, or I'm not going to give, or I'm already giving, you know, £10 a month to this, that, or the other. And yet they're living in what at any other period of history would have been considered princely estate. So you think that your £10 is enough. You know, actually, if in a wealthy country like this, the wealthiest people gave a much higher percentage of their income. It has been shown by recent research that the United Nations Millennium Development Goals could be achieved fairly easily. So we think that we're separate. It's Britain versus everybody else. It's our economy versus other economies. That we're on our own. We're not. Completely interinvolved. Globalisation means something quite different from what it usually taken to mean. So we live in a society that is underlain by various attitudes and views. Attitudes and views underlie all human activity. Everything we do emerges out of our idea about who we are and what our society is, what it is to be a human being in relation to other human beings. Beneath everything we do, every step we take, every glance we make, attitudes are buried. This might sound a bit arcane, but it's not at all. Decisions that you make, whether to go this way or that way, are underlain by views. Yes, you want to do that. Why do you want to do that? You want to do that because you believe something about what is good, and you think it'll be fulfilled by that. But what you believe will be good is determined by various understandings of what is the good, if you see what I mean. We're children of the 21st century. we surely should learn from the 20th century and the power of ideas in the 20th century, the huge amount of evil and suffering and death that came from the power of National Socialism, the power of state communism, and the power of Marxist-Leninism. The three great destructions of the 20th century of course, the final solution in Germany, the collectivization and the extermination of the kulaks in Soviet Russia, and the Cultural Revolution in China. Together, I can't remember the figures, it's something like 20 or 30 million people died directly as a result of these actions, and probably far more indirectly. The famines that were generated in China and Russia as a result of ideas. Ideas about what human life was, what was best. I'm reading an astonishing novel, which I highly recommend, by Vasily Grossman, called Life and Fate. It's been a bit in the news recently, written by a Russian journalist who was at Stalingrad. And it's a novel about the influence of ideas on human activity, the influence of National Socialism, the influence of communism. It's extremely well played out. The way in which natural human sympathies are perverted, distorted, blunted by ideas. The ideas that we have shape our activity, our relationship to other people, and so on. So you can have an idea that because of somebody's skin colour, because of their race, Because of their nationality, they're bad, they're wrong. Because of their caste, they're wrong. And good people, nice people, can act inhumanly because of those ideas. People who are kind to others in other contexts can act an astonishing inhumanity. One of the amazing things in India, you know, I have friends across all of the caste spectrum. And one of the things, you know, I can see, because it's not my culture, I can see people have no understanding of the sufferings of lower castes and blame them. Just as, you know, I couldn't see that I blamed people from other races for being uppity, if you see what I mean. Jana, shut up. So our ideas shape our responses to the world to a far greater degree than we realise. You know, Britain believed in the 19th century that it had a duty, a right to colonise. It was led by ideas about a natural superiority, the superiority of our Christian faith, of our race, and so forth, etc. I don't need to labour the point. I hope you've got it. We're all of us, in all our activities, motivated by our fundamental understanding of what it is to be a human being and what is the good. And the most important thing that we can do is to change our understanding. If we can change our understanding, our actions naturally begin to change. Of course, to change that understanding, you need to do some work on your actions as well. But the ideas that we hold are vitally important, and it's these that we need to clarify and bring into line with humanity, with reality, with what really is. The Buddha judges ideas by their outcome. He judges ideas by whether they lead to non-harm, whether they lead to not taking what is not given, whether they lead to misusing sex, whether they lead to truthfulness, whether they lead to awareness. So ideas are vitally important, but they're only important because of their outcome, if you see what I mean. And ideas are to be judged by how you act on their basis. And the actions that you judge are ones that basic human decency shows you. You can tell what cruelty is. You know what it is, if you're honest with yourself. In Vasily Grossman's book, he shows you KGB officers doing utmost cruelty, and he just shows you a glimpse of them realising what they're doing, but covering it over with their ideology and their fear of Stalin, of course, their fear that they'll be there too. So if we allow our natural humanity to show through, we can tell what is good. And ideas, we need to have ideas that support that. That is what the Buddhist Dhamma is about. It's about ideas that support selflessness, that support non-harm, that support non-grasping. Of course, I could say so much about what those ideas are, but this is not the occasion. You need to, if you don't already, to study the Dhamma. Ideas about impermanence of all things. The fact there's nothing that you can grasp onto. The impermanence of your own self-identity. Your own self-identity is largely a construction, a relative construction that is constantly changing, and that ultimately is not something that can be defended. These sort of ideas underpin natural humanity, and a humanity that ultimately depends upon transcending self. So our duty, I would say, as Buddhists, is to bring the power of the Dhamma to bear on the widespread attitudes and ideas in society, to enter into discussion and dialogue with the society around us, to try to put across a point of view that supports genuine humanity, the point of view of the Dhamma, so that we, well, we challenge the prevailing materialism. And there are plenty of people who want to hear. There's a lot of doubt about it at the moment. A lot of doubt about it. People are sending lots of messages on their iPads about it. It's the irony of the situation. you know, there are forces that we can talk to, many of them. Many people are interested in a more humane outlook, in a perspective on what it is to be a human being that is more satisfying. But we need to get into dialogue. We need that perspective to be heard. Heard very, very widely and very, very deeply in the corridors of power. We began our assault on the House of Lords yesterday. We'll move on to the House of Commons later. To name a rather small power in the world. If we can get to the bankers, that might be more significant. And the captains of industry. But yes, we need to get this message of the Dhamma across very deeply. It's something we've hardly begun to do because Buddhism's so new. The perspective for the Dhamma is so new for the West. It's changed hugely in my time. I came across Buddhism in, don't gasp, 1969. And at that time, well, I remember somebody saying, you know, to be a Buddhist, you had to be some kind of a nut. It probably wasn't that bad by my stage. You just had to be a bit screwy, as it were. But, you know, it really wasn't widespread, the knowledge of Buddhism. It's now pretty well known and very well thought of by and large, even by people of other persuasions. But the Buddhist point of view is a deeply human point of view. A very reasonable point of view. I'm in the middle of writing an article for a book to be published under the editorship of the Dean of Christchurch in Oxford called Sensible Religion. So mine's on sensible Buddhism. And it's made me sort of aware just how sensible Buddhism is. It's common sensible, if you see what I mean. We're not asking you to believe anything that you can't test and know in your own experience, maybe not immediately but gradually. So we're not sort of asking people to sort of lay aside their common sense, their rational faculty. We're not asking people to lay aside their humanity. We're not asking people to separate themselves from the human community, you know, like some of these extreme Protestant sects where they conceive of themselves as being the only chosen ones. And so on. We're asking. We have a perspective in the Dhamma that can challenge prevailing views and move them in a humane direction, in a sensible direction, in a very deep direction that can provide people with a very deep human satisfaction. And it's so much needed. Not just in places like India, where you know, there's still oppressive systems in being. Like I told you, I'm working in Hungary, where there's a prevailing, widespread nationalist, racist perspective, very, very widespread. But also, we need to challenge the views here at every level: the popular views, the common views, the English Defence League, whatever. The views of the bankers, the views of the politicians. We need to get our point of view across, and we're in a position, I think, now, as never before, to do that. So that's my second area, huge topic, but I hope you got the nub of it, that the power of the Dhamma needs to be brought to bear upon the prevailing attitudes and views within society. My third area, again, I'm going to talk about this even more briefly, because I hope it's very evident to you, because you're probably mainly representatives of it. Probably what's brought you through the door here is some sense that the ordinary conventional life is inadequate. That a life of buying, gaining satisfaction, losing your satisfaction, becoming discontented and buying again until you die is not really worth it. It just isn't worth it. It doesn't really add up to what all this promises, this wonderful sort of kit of chemistry and biology and so forth and psychology. It really is worth more than that. We're worth more than sheep. I'm not saying anything against sheep, but I have to be careful. I live with 800 of them. But we're more than sheep. We've got capacities, powers within us that go beyond the mere level of animal existence. And you probably come here because you sense that. You might not have articulated itself to that to yourself particularly, but that's probably why you've mostly come here. You want something more, even if it's peace, even if it's just clarity of mind or greater happiness or something like that. It's something more than the ordinary run of things deliver you. You come here probably because you think that you may get some help in that. You may get something that will help you to find that greater satisfaction in yourself. And I think a very large number of people feel this. I remember many years ago when the order was first founded, and I was one of the early order members. I think there were 30 of us at that stage in the whole world, in North London. And I remember meeting with our teacher, again, Sangharakshita, who'd come down from his hermitage to London, and he'd been into the centre of London on a shopping spree. What a shopping spree meant to him was a round of all the bookshops, buying the latest philosophy, poetry, etc. He reported an experience he'd had on the train coming back, on the tube coming back. He said he'd sort of sat there and just looked around at people, and he'd sort of got an impression, oh, that person there, there's something in their eye, there's something, you know, they want something more. They're not quite sort of stuck in this, as it were. You know, most people are just going chuggity, chuggity, chug. But there's some people who sort of, you get a pick up from them, a sense that they really do want something more. They know that they're sort of owed something more, as it were, that they could have something more. And he said that his impression was that maybe 10% of people have that feeling. And of course young people are more likely often to not just have that feeling but know they've got that feeling. There's a wonderful passage in one of Nietzsche's books, Schopenhauer's Educator, where he talks about what young person doesn't wake in the midst of the night and reflect, there must be something more. This is all it is? It must be something more. So that is a large part of the population. People who really sense that there could be something more. Many find their way into art or into altruistic activity or one way or something like that. Some people just channel it into ambition, or just get involved in the business of life. They forget it, but. It's a huge sort of resource for humanity that there are people who want something more. Want something more of quality, that is, not quantity. Who want some greater value from their lives and believe that life is capable of something more, even if they don't know where to look for it. The Dhamma is made for them. The Dhamma life is about revealing that potential that we have, that particularly that capacity that we have to transcend ourselves, to go beyond our self-clinging, to go beyond our self-obsession, to stop living just for me, for my satisfaction. Not bad to be satisfied, not bad to have personal enjoyment and pleasure. There's more to it than that. And the Buddhist life is about that. And I know myself that if I hadn't encountered the Dhamma when I encountered it, when I was 24, well, 23, 22, okay, 21. Yes, 21. I really think that I probably would have destroyed myself in one way or another, probably with drugs. Either that, I'd have destroyed myself by just checking in and joining the rat race, which would have been another kind of death. And I know what that would have done to me. I can feel what that would have done to me. A biting, deep sense of depression. I think I'd have lived with that. Speak for myself. If I hadn't come across the Dhamma in a form that I could relate to, and that I could live out, and live a pretty decent and satisfying life. Yeah, I can't buy an iPad, I know, but it's a pretty good life, a satisfying life. And I'd really like that 10% of the population who feel that, maybe it's more, to have that opportunity. It doesn't have to be from us. It could come from other sources. I don't care. But I would like all those who feel a call to a higher life of some kind, to put it that way. Higher has odd connotations, but to living a more fulfilling life of deeper value, I'd like them to have that opportunity. There are other opportunities. It's not just us. But Buddhism puts all this in a particularly clear and unambiguous way, and an uncomplicated way. It doesn't mix it up with superstition. It doesn't mix it up with a premature mythology, as it were. I won't go on advertising Buddhism. But it's our duty, surely, having a duty, I mean, in a very positive sense of something that your consciousness presents to you as necessary. It's our duty to provide that opportunity for others who want it. That's why this centre was founded. I had a large hand in founding it. I found it, and I was involved in the team that set it up. And I set it up so that you could encounter the Dhamma, just as I'd encountered the Dhamma, because somebody else had set things up for me. And ultimately the Buddha set it up for us. It's a big contribution, of course, to those people. But who are those people? They're people who want value, who want higher values, and that therefore who can give high values to society, if you see what I mean, who can provide for the overall society its moral leaven, what raises it up. If there aren't people like that, everything becomes dead level. You can see that with what Grossman shows in communist Russia, the way in which everything is just being chopped down. Every poet, every great thinker, every artist ultimately goes into Lubyanka and is put up against a wall or sent off to Siberia, to the gulags. Very, very difficult for them to survive. Only a few really great figures emerged from that. Mandelstam, etc. All repressed, suppressed. Tarkovsky had to leave Russia. If a system doesn't honour, doesn't value that element within society, if it doesn't provide space for it and encouragement for it, even support for it, the society becomes numb, becomes dead level, becomes routine. It becomes a shopping mall. Oh, I said that with some conviction. Have you ever experienced that? You go into a big shopping mall, and it's really glitzy and extraordinarily well done, and the goods are really well displayed and everything, and you have that feeling that you're going to go mad and have a sort of, some sort of terrible attack, because there's nothing that takes you upwards. Maybe I've been in the wrong shopping malls. But if for society as a whole, for society to have moral values, there needs to be that higher value that's lived and shared by many people. by at least a significant proportion of humanity. Well, you remember Shelley famously and maybe self-servingly argued that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. Well, you could say that to broaden that out, it's those with a poetic spirit, in the metaphorical sense, those with some spirit alive in them, who are the real formers of our social culture, and who are the real creators of the atmosphere, and who can lift others up who don't feel that, can't feel that for whatever reason, who can lift them up. So these are a vitally important constituency for the Dhamma revolution. These are the people in the end who are going to contribute to the change in social attitudes, the change in ideas and values. These are the people who are going to want to help the poor and oppressed and help them to get out of their suffering. These are the people who are going to want to really change things. And they are the people who above all need help. This is what our concentration has been up until now. I believe we need to reach out from our Tri Ratna movement much more than we have done till now. But I excuse us on the grounds that we've been mainly trying to build the basis for those of us who have this sense of something more. And this is where I want to conclude. I want to conclude by emphasising the importance for each and every one of us of building up a core where you can share the spirit of transcendence, where you can come in contact with others who feel the same impulse as you do, the same sense of disquiet, of limitation, dis-ease, and the same glimpse, maybe not very clear, inchoate, not very easily put into words or images, but a sense that there is something bigger and brighter possible for humanity. It's really important that people who have that sense come together. When we come together, we reinforce each other. And especially when you're in the early stages of trying to separate that out from other motives and impulses within you, you really need a lot of encouragement and support. I know this myself. I had from a quite early age a sort of impulse to something more, but I know I could not have isolated that, committed myself to it, and made it a substantial part of my life as it is now, if I hadn't had help, guidance, support, encouragement, friendship. If I hadn't had people around me who saw what I meant. You know, people who didn't say to me, "Never mind, dear, have another cup of tea." You know what I mean? And who they say, "Well, why don't you go shopping? turn on the telly." You know, whatever it is, the normal things that people do to sort of keep things rolling along and keep the yawning abyss on which we live out of our sight. So you divert your gaze from that yawning abyss to the telly or the shopping or whatever it is. It's sometimes really, you know, you just feel this is impossible. It's all a chimera. It's not real. Just something, you know, it's opium of the people. It's something people have sort of cooked up to stave off depression. And you need to be with people who believe in it too. You need to be with people who not only believe in it too, but who've even got further with it than you. And even people who embody it to a very substantial degree, who live it, at least to a very much greater degree than you do. Perhaps only the Buddha and his like live it fully. But there are people amongst us who live it more fully than others. That's the nature of spiritual life. So we need to be with each other. We need to gain that that sense of courage, of confidence, of enrichment, and something more than that. It's quite difficult to put your finger on, or put into words, put your tongue on. We need to actually feel it. Feel it as something real and living. And I stick my neck out. I suspect most of you, when you've come here, have sensed something around, something in the atmosphere. That's not just to do with anything in particular. That people here do believe in this greater life. They do believe in that it's possible for a human to live out higher values. And that is, to a small extent, imperfectly, inadequately, patchily, we have our good days and our bad days, is part of what we have here. And that we share with each other, that we participate in, and that we contribute to. And that is ultimately the first touch of these Dharma processes. These processes that transcend us as individuals. Through our common life together, whether it's a class, a community, or a people working together, people just going out for an evening. We had a wonderful spiritual community going to the House of Lords yesterday. It was wonderful. You sense something more than just the individuals. It's not anything else either. It's not, you know, God come down to earth or anything like that. It's something that's generated amongst you that's more than you, but that's not denying you. Our teacher talks about a third order of consciousness. He talks about what he calls group consciousness. I hope my 800 sheep are not listening. But they don't have individual consciousnesses. They're quite individual in some ways. But essentially, they participate in sheepiness. And, that no sheep is going to really rock the boat or push the boundaries of the field. They're going to be a sheep. And that's that. So you can see they are sort of linked in a consciousness, but it's a consciousness which has no individuality to it. They're participating in sheepy life. As a human being, we participate in that too. There's a human level of group identity. We function to some extent as an animal pack. One of my great joys in India, on one of our retreat centres, is out in the jungle, and lots of monkeys come. And I like sitting on the balcony and just watching the monkeys and then looking at my fellow retreatants and trying to work out what the difference is. And, of course, having a glance inwards as well. There's a level of us that is of that kind. Quite a large level of us. But, you know, we begin to be more conscious of ourselves as individuals. We begin to feel that we're not just bound up with everybody else. We try to develop some real sense of ourselves as separate, as responsible, and so forth. So a second order of consciousness evolves, which is individual consciousness. And this is what karma is about. It's about working with that individual consciousness. But there's another level of consciousness where, having developed that individuality to a very high degree, you're able to transcend it. And you participate in a consciousness that is neither group nor individual, but has sort of elements of both, where you feel entirely in tune with others, with other life, all life. At the same time, you're fully yourself. You don't lose yourself, but you experience yourself as completely part of a larger whole. And you feel, even may present itself to you, as if there's something working through you. Not that there is literally something outside you working through you, but it's so not your usual experience of I that seems like something from outside you. a very, very moving passage I came across quite recently in a letter written by our teacher, Ogyen Sangrajta, to a friend in India. He was in India on the 6th of December 1956, when the great Dr. Ambedkar, who I mentioned yesterday, died. And of course, it was just 5 weeks after conversion. So his people were left leaderless. They'd just made this huge step, didn't really yet know what it meant, and their leader had gone. And he happened to be at the epicentre of that movement on the day that this death took place. And he was a monk at that time, he was highly respected already, but people came to him and said, "We don't know what to do. We just don't know what to do. Please help us." So he called a big meeting, and hundreds of thousands of people came together, literally. And he said that one after another, Dr. Ambedkar's leaders, followers, who were the leaders of the movement, got up to speak and just broke down in tears. None of them could speak. They were just so overwhelmed by sorrow and also by fear. They were completely bereft of guidance. And he felt that the sort of weight of the whole occasion, and not just that particular occasion, sort of descending upon him. He got up and just spoke, sort of saying, "Well, yes, what a terrible loss we've had. But Dr. Ambedkar lives in you. We together can continue his work." Sounds very prosaic when you say it now, but I know people who were there and said it just changed the atmosphere. He said that over the next 3 days, he gave 30 talks, all hours of day and night. It just, he was needed, he responded. And he said, he wrote to his friend that his whole experience during that time was very peculiar, very strange. He said he felt as if he was an impersonal force. He said that he would often get up to speak without any preparation. He had not thought about what he was going to say. And he would speak without thought, as if he was in deep meditation. And whatever was needed, he would say. And as if, he was an impersonal force, which is a quite uncomplicated way of expressing it, as if it wasn't his person doing things, but that something was happening. And he said that when he left Nagpur after 4 days, almost without sleep, of constant work, he felt completely rested and refreshed. So to me, this is a very clear exemplification of this sort of spirit of third order, of going beyond self, not to something else, something more, if you like, and that he was able to respond, sort of putting himself aside, but completely from himself, and completely appropriately. I gave a talk on in Nagpur on that day this year, and I made reference to that in the talk, which is the one that was broadcast to 2 million people over Lord Buddha TV. I'm rich and famous. No, I'm famous, but not rich. When I was speaking, something started to happen. It happened again. The audience and I moved into another level of consciousness, which I certainly don't feel I was responsible for, if you see what I mean. I was giving the talk, so I was the sort of catalyst for it. But something happened to me, happened to everybody else, that we just passed into another state of mind, which just hovered there, shimmered there, for a while. And, I continued to talk out of that, sort of almost not knowing what to say, just speaking kind of what came out of the audience to me, as it were. And then it sort of died away and we all went home. But just for a while, in making reference to that, I was able to move into it myself, and my audience came into it too, and it's, as I say, it became quite well known, that talk. I'd sort of connected with something that Sangharakshita had connected with, and that had connected my audience with it. And this is the Dharma Niyama processes. This is these processes that go beyond self. Unfortunately, I don't live there all the time. Unfortunately, probably most of us here don't live there all the time. But we do have access to it. And we have access to it particularly when we're together, when we come together, and often you can't plan it. You can't say, tonight I'll get them up there. You just can't do it. You know, the camera's rolling, lights, action, third order of consciousness. It doesn't work. It just has to happen. But those conditions are more likely to come about when people who are practicing the Dhamma, practicing karma, really seriously, studying the Dhamma, getting their minds clear, when they're together. And they're together in a spirit of trying to help each other and trying to help the world around. When we come together in that spirit, something new arises. And I hope that you've all had some touch of that in coming here. You know, in a festival or a class, or maybe even on an occasion when I'm rambling. Maybe something like that comes a little bit into... maybe not the thing itself, but an echo of an echo of an echo, or a reflection of a reflection, or a shadow of it passing across the room, as it were. That's what our order and movement are about. They're about creating the circumstances where that is most likely to come about, where we come together in a sufficiently deep and vivid way, living way, so that something more comes into play. And everything we do is aimed at that, even though we forget it all the time. We set up our centres, we have our classes, we organise, you know, we've got various institutions, like you can become a mitra, you can become an order member, and so on. We've got all these sort of building blocks, but they all have their meaning only if they become media for that other state of mind, that other state of consciousness. And once they cease to serve that, they should be confined to the dustbin of history. Unfortunately, what happens is they become the dustbin, but that's another question. That's what happens, isn't it? It freezes, and the form takes over from the content. So everything we do here is about that, ideally. And most of the time it is. We set up communities, for instance, where people can live together, and in that situation you've got a better chance, not always, not every time, a better chance of sort of being pulled beyond yourself and collectively being pulled beyond yourself. We've got businesses, and not so many around here anymore. Some of them failed, and, you know, just the ebb and flow of economics. We really want to have more around here, where people can work together, and their work can be something more than just gaining a livelihood, where through their working together, the circumstances are present where something more than them as individuals comes into play. Everything we do is ultimately about that. And this is really what the Dhamma is about. There are many words for it. I've spoken of it here as the Dhamma Niyama processes, those processes that come about under the law of Dharma, just as scientific laws bring about other processes. So I've spoken of it in those terms. Sometimes it's spoken of bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. So it's a mind that's more than the individual mind, but not different from the individual mind, to be suitably paradoxical. There are many ways of thinking and talking, but probably everybody's got some glimpse of it, and it's that that we're all about, and it's that that we need to strengthen. If we can bring that spirit strongly to life amongst us, then we can go out. The history of social action is littered with burnt out social workers. The history of politics is littered with idealistic people who've simply become part of the system, and genuinely idealistic people. I always felt this about Tony Blair. He was a sincerely idealistic man, but the business of politics is just really difficult to remain genuinely true to this spirit. And the way we remain true to it is by building a strong enough core of energy, as it were, amongst us, that we together create the spirit, the atmosphere, with which we can go out. I can go to Hungary into difficult situations where nobody thinks, oh, it's the great Savuti. It's just another, you know, Hungarian. I'm white, therefore I'm a Hungarian. Not a gypsy or a Roma. I've got that sort of, I carry that spirit with me, and I can stay alive in quite difficult circumstances where, you know, communication is very difficult at times. They're very kind to me, they're very good to me, I'm not speaking about that, but I can't sort of really get across anything that I would like to. But I can do it, I can go there and patiently wait, work with my friends, support them, communicate that with them, link them to this spirit. We need this, we need this desperately, the world needs it. We've spoken of it, Sangharakshita, our teacher, has spoken of it as the nucleus of a new society. So it's perhaps rather outdated language. New societies sends shivers down one's backbones, maybe. But if one thinks of a new society as a society in which karma and dharma are dominant, the dominant force, then we need a nucleus. You need people who not only have the motivation but have the spirit, and who operate from that spirit, and who are sustained by that spirit through sharing it together. And this is the function and project of our Triratna Buddhist order and movement. That's what it's all about. That's what we're inviting you into, as far as you want to come. We're inviting you to benefit from that, if you can find it, if it's there. If you don't find it, please go away. Find it somewhere else. But if you find it, well, you're welcome to take advantage of it. And, of course, you can't be passive in that, because that spirit is not a product, in the commercial sense. It's a spirit. So you can only benefit from it by participating in it. If you involve yourself with it, you benefit from it. The more you engage yourself with it, the more deeply you will benefit from it. And we try to provide means by which anybody who wants to, and it's very much voluntary, the thing cannot work by compulsion. It just dies if it's compelled. Witness Soviet Union. We invite you in, we invite you to take advantage of that spirit and to learn, you know, the techniques and methods that will enable you to practice karma more and more fully and richly and deeply. But above all, we invite you to participate, to involve yourself, to contribute, to become part of it at your own pace, in accordance with your own circumstances and situation. You can go as fast, as slow as you like, as deep or as relative as you like. But that's what this whole thing is about. It's about building up a strong core of people who, between them, carry this spirit and are able then to go out to the poor, oppressed, deprived, and help them to lift themselves up. Who are able to, on the basis of that spirit, go into the wider society and try to promote more satisfying, more adequate views. And who we can go out and try to reach those who feel as we do, that there's something more to life. That's what it's all about. And it's interesting. Really, the whole movement, the whole Triratna movement, comes out initially of Sangharakshita's own work, came back to England alone. And he says that his feeling is that he didn't found it, that something sort of more than him, that wasn't not him, founded it sort of through him. Just as he experienced in Nagpur in 1956. In 1967 and 8, when he founded the movement and the order here, he was motivated by the same sense of these processes that emerge in the individual, but which take you beyond self-clinging. So what we aspire to, what I believe we manage to do, is share that amongst us and keep it alive, and we invite you to participate in it and to become part of it as fully as you like. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.